Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined by the leading presidential historian of our time, Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and her latest book, Leadership in Turbulent Times, is now available wherever you buy your books. She examines the presidencies of Abraham Lincoln, both Roosevelt's, and Lyndon Johnson, as they all came to power amid different situations in this nation that cried out for leadership. Doris, before we get into the new book, next year has arrived for your beloved Boston Red Sox four times since your beautiful memoir, Wait Till Next Year, was published in the late 90s. What's it like for you as a Boston Red Sox fan to expect a World Series title every year as opposed to bracing for disappointment?
No, it's really bizarre. I mean, there's still that part of every fan that thinks at the end something is going to happen badly, even though we had that 108-game wins this year. And I guess that'll never go. But then when you stand back and say, my God, the 21st century, you know, four times, it's really lucky. It doesn't lose its excitement. Probably nothing will be the same as that first time we won after all those camaraderie years of almost always winning and then almost always losing. But it's still pretty special, and it was a wonderful team this year.
All right, well, now to this book. The leaders you chose, did all four of them jump right out at you from the outset?
Well, I chose them because they were the four that I knew the best, and I knew if I was going to try and look at them in a new way. Usually when I finish a book, I get a new president, and then I have to move all the earlier presidents' books out of my study, and I feel vaguely guilty as if I'm leaving an old boyfriend behind. So this time I figured instead of getting a new president, I'd look at my guys in a new way. And I realized that if I was going to ask questions that I really hadn't asked before about, you know, when did they first see themselves as leaders, where did their ambition come from, you know, kind of personal questions that you have to really think about or find evidence of, that at best be the ones that I knew so that I could, you know, look at them anew in a different setting.
I know there's no single route to leadership, but what was it about the early lives of these men that suggested that they would become great leaders?
Well, what the early life suggested, probably except for Lincoln, where you could tell when he runs for office the first time and he says that, you know, everyone has this peculiar ambition. Mine is to be esteemed of by my fellow man, by making myself worthy of that esteem. That's an ambition that's larger than self. And that suggests that you might become a great leader, because that's a transformation that has to happen. I think the other three, when they first got into politics, it was simply that they were taking an adventure and going into something that they thought they would like. Even Teddy Roosevelt conceded later that when he first went to the state legislature at 23, he wasn't trying to make lives better, but then once he got into office and he saw the decrepit tenements and children in factories, he began to see the other world that his privileged life had not allowed him to see, and he wanted to change it, and that's when his ambition began to shift a little more. I think Lyndon Johnson, having grown up poor, as did Lincoln, was more aware of the need for collective help to, you know, make life better for poor people. But at the beginning, his ambition was really just to get power, as he said. He wanted to move up the rung of power. And so, too, with FDR. He was so excited when they asked him to run for the first time. Even with that insulated life, once he got out on that barnstorming trail, he loved it. And he loved listening to people and talking to them. He found his vocation. So I'd say they all found their vocation in their 20s. William James says there's a moment when a voice within says, this is the real me. But it took some longer than others to attach that vocation to something greater than the self, and that's what allowed them potentially to become a great leader.
Well, the thing I found interesting about Teddy Roosevelt was that he was essentially tapped on the shoulder and told to run for office, right?
Correct. I mean, they knew he came from the silk stocking area. They knew his father was a well-known philanthropist, and they knew he could probably help to fund the campaign. So he was the right choice. Similarly for Franklin Roosevelt, when they chose him, they knew that he would be running as a Democrat, but that the Roosevelt name by then, Teddy Roosevelt's name, former president, would be helpful because some Republicans might think, oh, it's old Teddy running again, so that Franklin Roosevelt would get double the vote.
Before I read this book, the turbulent times for Lincoln, FDR, and LBJ were all obvious to me. The Teddy Roosevelt era is less well known. So what crises did he face as he entered the White House?
Interesting, because he had a hidden crisis that he recognized and that allowed him to be able to mobilize the power of the people and the government to help out. I mean, the Industrial Revolution had shaken up the economy much as the technological revolution and globalization have done today. And there was a big gap for the first time between the rich and the poor. The working class were really in a restless state. There were a lot of nationwide strikes going on, you know, really arguing against the terrible wage conditions and the conditions in the factories. There were bombings in the streets, lots of immigrants coming in from abroad, so there was a populist movement using them as a scapegoat for the problems of the working class. And there was a really strong feeling that revolution was in the air. So he sensed all of that, and he was able to move and mobilize the conservative Republicans in the Congress by making the power of the people bared to them to begin to soften the worst aspects of the industrial order, to break up the big monopolies that were, you know, swallowing up smaller ones, and regulate the corrupt railroads and the food and drug industry. So it was not a crisis that was visible to everyone at the time, but his seeing it allowed him to take charge and forward action on it before it emerged into something even bigger.
With FDR and the Great Depression, it seems like the entire nation understood how dire the situation was at the time. These days, people seem divided along party lines as they describe the condition of the country. So how did FDR manage this low morale across virtually the entire country?
Yeah, it's one of the mysteries of leadership that a president or a leader can, you know, by example and his mood and his words, begin to change the morale of an entire group of people. I mean, that first inaugural address, and then his first fireside chat, people said really they felt differently about themselves. He told the people that this isn't your fault that you don't have a job, because many of them felt they had failed and they were looking at it separately. He said, we're all in this together. The system has failed us, and the answer to the system failure is to take action, and that's what I'm going to propose. And when people felt we're at least beginning to move toward making things better, and when he described to them the reason they couldn't get their money out of the bank, and they were trying to take it away and fearfully put it under their mattresses, was because some of the banks had invested in the stock market and the cash had gone away. But he had passed a bill that would shore up those weaker banks, and he assured them that it would be okay to bring their money back. So when the banks opened after a week of being closed, there was terror. What if they start taking it out even more? The whole system will collapse. But instead, amazingly, there's pictures of them in satchels bringing their money back to the banks, which meant that the first crisis, the banking crisis, was solved, and then he could go on to solve the more systemic problem.
Well, the fireside chats were so famous for making Americans really believe that FDR was essentially in their living rooms with them. How come no president has ever copied that play since then?
Well, you know, I think what it took on the radio was, first of all, they could be, you know, 30 minutes or 40 minutes long, so that it would be hard for television to do that. Although I think presidents could have copied it more on television, although there's something about the radio and you're sitting in front of your living room radio or the kitchen and you're listening that you really can't imagine that the president's talking to you. One of my favorite anecdotes has to do with a construction worker who was hurrying home one night, and his partner said, where are you going? And he said, well, my president's coming to speak to me in my living room. It's only right that I be there to hear him when he comes. FDR had that intimate voice, a conversational style of speaking. I mean, every word that was more than one syllable, he would try and cut down so that it could be a conversation, not a speech to the people. And he addressed the people as my friends. And in his mind, he pictured a girl behind a shop counter or a mason or a construction worker. And he would practice it in front of a group of people over and over again and make gestures as if he were speaking to a group, even though he's just speaking, of course, to that microphone. And those 35 side chats were really absolutely instrumental in the bond that he created with the people. At every moment when there needed to be some real problem explained and a solution provided and some mandate for what the people should do as well as the government, he went on that radio in critical moments during World War II, later during the Depression. It's an extraordinary thing. I think when he died, people recognized what they missed. They hugged each other on the streets and they said, my friend is gone. We're lonely without him. So that's part of the extraordinary power that leadership can have when it connects individually to the individual people.
It seems like with both Roosevelt's and with Abraham Lincoln, they were dealing with things directly with the American people. LBJ getting his Civil Rights Act through Congress, he was having to lobby a lot of the congressmen, congresspeople. How did he lobby these members to get past the filibuster?
Well, that's where, you know, it's so interesting. So his worry, his constituency in those first 6 months was the Congress. I mean, of course, the American people, he had to educate them as to what the Civil Rights Bill desegregating the South was about. But his first trial was to get enough people to break the filibuster that the Southern Democrats were beginning to mount, and that cut the Democratic Party in two. So he knew that his goal was to reach out to the Republicans and hope that he could get them to come to help break the filibuster. And that meant reaching out to Everett Dirksen, and that meant having drinks with Dirksen, promising Dirksen everything. You know, you want a postmastership in Peoria? Yes. You want me to come to Springfield, Illinois? I'll be there. You want an ambassadorship for a certain person? Okay, it's done. But then he also understood that Dirksen really cared about his own role in history. So he says to him, Everett, you come with me on this bill and you bring some Republicans, and 200 years from now, school children will know only two names, Abraham Lincoln and Everett Dirksen. But then in addition to that, so that helped to get the leader of the Republicans, the minority leader, on board. But he just would call up the congressman at 6 a.m., at noon, at midnight, even called a senator at 2 a.m. I hope I didn't wake you up. I just wanted to speak to you. And the senator said, no, I was just lying here hoping my president would call. It meant endless work. It meant knowing which individual senators or congressmen wanted what in terms of trading in order to make this happen, which ones he could persuade that this was so important for the history of the country. And he never stopped. I mean, he never slept. And then the amazing thing is, once the Civil Rights Act passed, then he wanted to go further. And then there was voting rights. And then there was fair housing and Medicare and aid to education and NPR and PBS. Those 18 months before the war started really heating up are almost unparalleled, except for the 100 days with FDR.
Did any of these four presidencies occur during times where people are as partisan as they are now?
No. No. Well, obviously, you would argue for Abraham Lincoln when the North and the South are divided. You know, that's a much more difficult situation than what we have now. And in fact, you know, what should give us some solace is that if you were alive during the time of Lincoln, you were in a much more difficult situation than we are now. I mean, 600,000 of your fellow Americans are going to die. It's not clear until the end of the war that the country's ever going to come back together again. And obviously, during those first 100 days of the New Deal, when the Depression was still at its peak and people were in need of jobs and there's hunger in the streets, it's a worse situation than now. And even the racial situation was heating up and not healed, it seemed, when LBJ took office, plus an assassination attempt that nobody knew for sure what might be part of a conspiracy. But what we're seeing now with the Piper partisanship, it's certainly the worst it's been in my lifetime. I mean, even during that LBJ period, and then even later during Reagan's period, Republicans and Democrats saw each other as human beings. They stayed in Washington on the weekends. They played poker together. They drank together. Many of them had been in a war situation, whether it was World War II or Korean War or later the Vietnam War, so they knew somehow what it was like to have a common mission across party lines or across racial lines. So they looked to each other. They felt loyalty to the Senate or the Congress that was more than loyalty to their party. And something's fallen apart in these last 30 years. It has to do with the money that's raised, with the gerrymandering of districts, with the divided media world, so that you're only watching your own party's media source. But it's something that I think the majority of the people in the country so badly want to see softened, and the toxic culture that it's created changed.
You spent a great deal of time working with LBJ, first in the White House. How did the White House job come about?
Well, I was originally a graduate student at Harvard getting my PhD when I was nominated for a program called the White House Fellows Program, which still exists today, a fabulous program. Brings people from outside government for a year into government. Colin Powell was a White House Fellow, Wesley Clark. So I was 24 when I was selected, and we had a big dance at the White House after our nomination. I did dance with President Johnson. It wasn't that peculiar. There were only three women out of the 16 White House Fellows. But as he twirled me around the floor, he whispered he wanted me to be assigned directly to him in the White House. But it was not to be that simple, for in the months leading up to my selection, like so many young people, I was active in the anti-Vietnam War movement and had written an article against him, which unfortunately we'd sent to the New Republic several weeks before, had heard nothing, and then it suddenly came out after the dance, and the title they put on it was How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power. So I was certain he would kick me out of the program. But surprisingly, he said, oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can. So I did eventually end up working for him in the White House, and then accompany him to his ranch to help on his memoirs, the last years of his life. it was an extraordinary experience. I mean, to be able to spend so many hours, you know, with this aging lion of a man. So sad was he in those last years on the ranch that he knew his legacy had been cut in two by the war, that he opened up to me in ways you probably wouldn't have had I known him at the height of his power. And I'd like to believe that privilege fired within me the drive to understand the inner person behind the public figure that I've tried to bring to each of my books since then. Probably would not have been a presidential historian had it not been for Lyndon Johnson.
You're a 24-year-old woman. You're a young woman going to work with him. Johnson sort of had a reputation as a womanizer. Was that thought ever in your mind?
Yes. And in fact, I was constantly talking to him about steady boyfriends, even when I had no boyfriends at all. And everything was working perfectly until one day he said he wanted to discuss our relationship, which sounded ominous when he took me nearby to the lake, conveniently called the lake Lyndon Johnson. And there was wine and cheese, red check tablecloth, all the romantic trappings. And he started out, "Doris, more than any other woman I have ever known," and my heart sank. And then he said, "You remind me of my mother." It was pretty embarrassing given what was going on in my mind. But anyway, that was it. We were okay after that, and we became good friends. And I really, as I say, realized how you take it for granted when you're 24 years old that you're spending, you know, many days with a president, actually living at the ranch. And now I realize what a great privilege it was.
Well, he was the only one of these four that you ever met. So how did he revere the power of the presidency?
I think what happened is that he had sought power all his life, really, and had reached a point when he was the majority leader of the Senate in 1955, where he was the most powerful majority leader that the Senate had ever seen. But then what happened, interestingly, is 6 months after that, he had a massive heart attack. He was only in his 50s. And when he came out of the depression that ensued from that attack, he said to himself, "What if I died now? What would I be remembered for?" And then he began to shift and realize he wanted more of a sense of purpose to his power, not just accumulating power. So he got through the first Civil Rights Act in the Senate, even though it was a mild act. It was the first one since Reconstruction. And then when he got into the presidency, he made civil rights his first priority. And I think that that's when power becomes something different than just for self. That's when his ambition for self, as I said at the beginning, becomes an ambition for the greater good.
As a presidential historian, in your mind, how long does it take once a president is out of office before that president's legacy can be fully understood?
I really think it takes maybe a generation. I mean, in part because you're so caught up in the context of the time, and it's hard to remove yourself from the swirling emotions of how you felt about the time as well as the person. And then also, it takes time for memoirs to come out. You know, in the old days, it would be time for diaries and handwritten letters to come out. All the sources that you need to really understand the inner person are going to come out over time. So, and then sometimes, you know, a generation later, a president can get reevaluated. You know, for example, I suppose, like, Truman left office in, you know, very low esteem. And then generations later, people realized, my God, what he did. You know, aid to Greece and Turkey, the containment policy, desegregating the armed forces, and also just the person he was, the extraordinarily decent person he was. So his stock continued to go up. I think Eisenhower, too, when he left office, there was a sense of wanting to move forward with a younger generation, dealing with some of the problems that hadn't been dealt with domestically in the 50s. And that yet later, when Vietnam came, the idea that there was no major war during that period of Eisenhower's time makes him look even better to that next generation. So much depends on where you are at the moment, and then you look back. But there's a pretty steadiness about who are the great presidents, who are the near great presidents. They're settling in as time goes by.
All right. Well, this book is truly amazing, and it's not some scholarly, nerdy piece of nonfiction. It is one that's written for everybody to understand and take from, and it's only about 400 pages long, so it is not a long read. The book is Leadership in Turbulent Times by Doris Kearns Goodwin, the Pulitzer Prize winner. It's available now wherever your books are sold. And if you haven't read Wait Till Next Year and you love baseball, go back and read that. That's a fantastic memoir. Doris, fantastic book here. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad we could talk.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Come on, baby, light my fire.